A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hannah sent us this one, and it's the kind of question that hits you right in the produce aisle. You're standing there. Organic apples, $3.99 a pound. Conventional, $1.99. Your toddler is about to eat the floor. What do you do?
That's the whole thing, isn't it? It's not theoretical. She's buying from a CSA here in Jerusalem. She's got little Ezra, who's now eating solid food, and also apparently sampling the floor tiles, and she's wondering, am I being smart about this, or am I just paying extra for a feeling?
Which is the question beneath the question. She's not asking, are pesticides real? She's asking, does my specific behavior, the CSA box, the organic cleaning products, the preference for organic everything, actually move the needle for my family's health? Or is this the consumer equivalent of a lucky charm?
She flags something that makes it especially relevant here. She's heard Israel's pesticide use is unusually high for a developed country, more on par with developing nations. She wants to know if that's true, and if it changes the calculus.
It is true, by the way. We'll get to the numbers. But the reason this matters right now is bigger than one family's grocery list. Microplastics, forever chemicals, pesticide residues, they're in the news constantly, and the signal-to-noise ratio is terrible. Every week there's a new study, a new headline, a new thing to be anxious about, and almost no one is helping people sort out what's worth acting on.
The stakes feel higher when you've got a one-year-old. Ezra was born last July, so he's right at that age where everything goes in the mouth. Hannah's instinct is to control what she can control, the food, the cleaning products. That's not irrational. The question is whether the specific things she's doing are the highest leverage moves.
That's what we're going to do. We're going to walk through the actual data on pesticide residues. What's on your food? What washes off? What doesn't? We're going to look at Israel's numbers specifically, because they're genuinely surprising. We're going to talk about what organic actually certifies versus what people think it certifies. And we're going to land somewhere practical. Not everything is fine and not everything is poison, but a framework for deciding where to spend your money and your worry.
Because the honest answer to, is this overkill, is not yes or no. It depends on the crop, the chemical, and your personal risk calculus, which sounds like a cop-out until you see the data, and then it becomes the only honest answer.
Hannah, we should say, we're not going to tell you you're being silly. You're asking exactly the right question. We're just going to give you the evidence to answer it better than the internet usually does.
Let's start with the basics. What does organic actually mean, and why is this question harder than it seems? The first thing that trips people up is the word itself. Organic sounds like it means pure or chemical-free, or from the earth as nature intended. But legally, it means something much narrower. A specific certification process that prohibits synthetic pesticides while allowing a list of approved natural ones. It's a farming standard, not a health guarantee.
That gap between what the word evokes and what it actually certifies, that's where a lot of the confusion lives. Hannah's buying from a CSA she trusts, and she's probably right to trust them. But the broader question of, does organic mean lower pesticide exposure, isn't as straightforward as the label implies.
So you've got three separate questions stacked on top of each other, and they often get mashed together in these conversations. Question 1. Does organic certification actually mean you're eating fewer pesticide residues? Question 2. If the answer is yes, does that reduction matter for your health in any measurable way? And question 3, which Hannah specifically raised, does living in Israel change the answer because the baseline pesticide exposure here is higher?
The reason those three need to stay separate is that you can get a clear yes on question 1, a muddy maybe on question 2, and a that complicates things on question 3. And if you don't disentangle them, you end up either panicking or dismissing the whole thing.
The skeptical position, and I suspect this is where Daniel lands, is that organic is mostly a marketing premium. You pay more for the same nutrition, the residues on conventional produce are below legal safety limits anyway, and the whole thing is anxiety monetized. And there's enough truth in that to make it sticky.
Legal limits are set for individual chemicals. They don't account for the strawberry that had 22 different residues on it. They don't account for what happens when you're exposed to low doses of multiple compounds over decades. The research on cumulative exposure is thin. And thin doesn't mean safe. It means we don't know.
Which is why the thesis we keep coming back to is, it depends on the crop, the chemical, and your personal risk calculus. That's not a dodge. It's the only honest answer once you look at the data. For some crops, the difference between organic and conventional is enormous and worth paying for. For others, it's negligible. The trick is knowing which is which.
For Hannah specifically, living in Israel with a one-year-old who treats the floor like a buffet, her risk calculus is different from someone in rural Vermont buying from a farmer's market once a week. So we need to look at Israel's numbers, and we need to look at what actually ends up on Ezra's plate and under his feet.
To answer that, we need to understand how pesticides actually work on the food we eat. Let's start with the data. The Environmental Working Group puts out an annual list, the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15, and their methodology is worth understanding before we argue about it.
Because people love to dismiss the EWG as alarmist, and people love to treat the list as gospel, and the truth is more interesting than either.
Their testing protocol is actually sensible. They test produce after washing and peeling the way consumers actually eat it. So they're not measuring field residues that would get rinsed off in your kitchen. They're measuring what's on the fork. The 2026 data is striking. The Dirty Dozen, strawberries, spinach, kale, nectarines, apples, grapes, peaches, cherries, pears, tomatoes, celery, potatoes, over 90% of samples had detectable pesticide residues.
The word detectable. There is doing something specific. It doesn't mean dangerous. It means the lab equipment found something. Modern mass spectrometry can detect parts per trillion. The question is whether those parts per trillion matter.
And that's where the dose response gap comes in. The WHO and the EPA set something called an acceptable daily intake, or ADI, for each pesticide. They find the highest dose that produces no observable adverse effect in animal studies. That's the NOAEL. And then they divide by 100, or sometimes 1,000. So the legal limit on your apple isn't the edge of safety. It's 1/100th of the dose that did nothing to a lab rat over its entire lifetime.
Which sounds reassuring until you remember that the strawberry in the EWG data had 22 different pesticide residues on a single sample, each one individually below the level of concern. But nobody tested what those 22 do together over 30 years of eating strawberries.
That's the cumulative exposure question, and the research is thin. We have excellent data on acute toxicity. What happens if a farm worker gets a concentrated dose? We have decent data on single chemical chronic exposure. We have almost nothing on the cocktail effect of low-dose multi-residue exposure over decades. The regulatory system wasn't designed to answer that question.
When someone says conventional produce is safe because residues are below legal limits, what they're really saying is each individual chemical considered in isolation is below a threshold that already includes a massive safety margin. That's not nothing. But it's also not the same as saying we've proven the whole picture is harmless.
That brings us to the washability factor, which is where a lot of practical advice goes wrong. Some pesticides are systemic. They're absorbed into the plant's tissue as it grows. You cannot wash them off because they're inside the cells. Others are surface-level contact pesticides that mostly come off with water and friction.
The person who says, just wash your produce and you're fine, is only right for some chemicals on some crops. For systemic pesticides, and strawberries are notorious for this, the residue is in the fruit, not on it.
Strawberries are actually the perfect case study for why this whole conversation resists simple answers. They consistently top the Dirty Dozen list. They're porous, they grow close to the ground, they're susceptible to fungal diseases, so they get sprayed heavily. The EWG found those 22 residues on one sample. But the EPA says each individual residue is below the level of concern. Which frame is more honest?
Both, which is infuriating. The EPA is factually correct about individual chemical thresholds. The EWG is factually correct about the total residue load. They're answering different questions, and the consumer is left holding a strawberry and wondering if she's poisoning her child, or being manipulated by a non-profit's fundraising strategy.
The Clean 15 tells a different story. Avocados, sweet corn, pineapple, onions, papaya, frozen sweet peas. Over 90% of samples had no detectable residues at all. And that makes intuitive sense when you think about it. Avocados have thick skins. Onions have protective layers. Sweet corn has a husk. The plant's own biology is doing the work.
Which is why the Clean 15 is where the skeptical position actually lands correctly. If you're buying conventional avocados, you're not getting meaningfully different pesticide exposure than organic. The premium isn't buying you anything real there.
Now let's bring this to Israel because Hannah's specific concern turns out to be well-founded. OECD data shows Israel uses approximately 5 to 6 kilograms of active pesticide ingredient per hectare of cropland. The OECD average is about 2.5. That puts Israel closer to Brazil at 6 kilograms per hectare than to peer developed nations. The Netherlands is around 3, France around 2.
Hannah's instinct that Israel is an outlier is dead on. The question is, why?
Three main reasons. First, intensive desert agriculture. The Negev produces an enormous amount of produce through drip irrigation and plastic culture, and those warm, humid conditions inside plastic tunnels are exactly what fungal diseases love. So you get heavier fungicide use. Second, Israel's pest pressure is high. We're at a crossroads of three continents in terms of insect migration patterns. Third, and this is the institutional one, Israel's regulatory system historically prioritized agricultural yield and food security over residue reduction. That's shifting, but slowly.
The fungicide point is worth underlining because it connects to something we'll get into later about organic certifications. Copper sulfate, which is widely used as a fungicide in both conventional and organic farming, is approved for organic use because it's natural. It's also toxic to aquatic life at high concentrations and accumulates in soil.
That's the thing about Israel's numbers. 5 to 6 kilograms per hectare sounds alarming, and it's high for a developed country. But the number alone doesn't tell you which pesticides, on which crops, at what persistence. Some degrade in days. Some hang around for months. The per hectare figure is a starting point for questions, not an answer.
Which is exactly where Hannah should be. Asking questions, not panicking. The data says Israel's baseline is higher, so her preference for organic has more grounding here than it might in, say, rural France. But it doesn't tell her which crops matter most, or whether her CSA is actually delivering what she thinks it is.
We know the residues are there, and we know Israel's numbers are high. But the organic label itself, what's it actually certifying? Because this is where a lot of people, and I think Hannah might be one of them, assume organic means no pesticides. That's not true.
It's not a scam exactly. It's more that the word organic has been stretched to cover a system that still uses chemicals, just different ones. The USDA organic label prohibits synthetic pesticides, but it maintains a list of approved natural substances. Copper sulfate, rotenone, pyrethrins, these are pesticides. They're just derived from natural sources rather than synthesized in a lab.
Copper sulfate is the one that always gets me. It's widely used as a fungicide in organic farming, especially on grapes and potatoes. It's natural, in the sense that it's a mineral compound. But at high concentrations, it's toxic to aquatic life. It accumulates in soil, and it doesn't just vanish because it's organic approved. The natural equals safe. Shortcut breaks down fast once you look at specific compounds.
That's the organic certification game in a nutshell. You're swapping one set of chemicals for another, with a different risk profile. The swap is probably net beneficial in most cases. Synthetic pesticides tend to be more persistent and more toxic to humans, but it's not the clean binary that the label implies.
The other thing that gets lost is the nutrition question. There was a big Stanford meta-analysis in 2012 that looked at 240 studies comparing organic and conventional produce. The finding was clear, no significant difference in vitamin or nutrient content. Organic produce is not more nutritious. The health benefit, if there is one, is reduced pesticide exposure, not extra vitamins.
Which is the halo effect trap. People see organic and their brain fills in healthier, more nutritious, better for me in every way. But the label doesn't certify nutrition. It certifies a farming method. An organic cookie is still a cookie.
That distinction matters for someone like Hannah, who's making budget decisions. If she's buying organic because she thinks Ezra is getting more vitamins, that money could be spent elsewhere. If she's buying it to reduce pesticide exposure, that's a different calculation, and one that the Dirty Dozen framework actually supports.
Let's talk about the floor-licking problem, because that's the other half of her question. She's buying organic or green cleaning products because Ezra treats the floor like a sampling platter. Is that overkill?
It depends on what she's replacing. The risk hierarchy for household chemicals is not flat. The dangerous stuff, drain cleaners, oven cleaners, bleach-based products, those can cause chemical burns or serious toxicity if ingested. Replacing those with safer alternatives is high leverage. But a lot of green cleaning products reduce volatile organic compounds, which is good for respiratory health, but they're not necessarily safer if a toddler drinks them.
The label natural or green on a cleaning bottle is doing the same thing as organic on produce. It's signaling something real but narrower than people assume. Seventh generation or method products reduce VOCs and avoid some of the harshest solvents. That's a real benefit. But if Ezra chugs a bottle of natural all-purpose cleaner, he's still going to the emergency room.
The practical advice here is boring but true. Store all cleaning products out of reach regardless of what the label says. For routine floor cleaning, especially with a kid who licks the floor, hot water and a mild soap like Castile soap is effective and safe. Vinegar and baking soda handle most of what you need. You don't need to replace every product in the house with a green alternative to meaningfully reduce risk.
Which brings us to the cost-benefit question. Hannah mentioned she's buying from a CSA here in Jerusalem and thinks it's actually a good deal. She's probably right. CSAs cut out retail markup, so the per-unit cost of organic produce through a CSA can be comparable to conventional at the supermarket. But for listeners who don't have CSA access, the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15 framework is the most evidence-based way to prioritize.
The rule of thumb is straightforward. If you can only afford organic for 5 to 10 items, make them the Dirty Dozen. Strawberries, spinach, kale, apples, grapes, and so on. Those are the crops where the residue difference between organic and conventional is largest. For clean 15 items, avocados, sweet corn, onions, pineapple, conventional is fine. You're not getting meaningfully different exposure.
One thing worth flagging about CSAs in Israel specifically, a lot of them farm organically in practice but skip the formal certification because it's expensive and bureaucratic. The certification process, whether it's Organic Israel or an EU equivalent standard, involves paperwork, inspections, and fees that small farms often can't justify. So Hannah's trust in her CSA is probably well placed. But it's worth asking, what certification, if any, do they hold? And if the answer is none, but here's how we farm, that's not necessarily a red flag.
The bigger picture here is that microplastics, PFAS, and pesticides are all real concerns, but they have different risk profiles. PFAS are persistent and bioaccumulative. They hang around in your body and the environment for years. Pesticides are designed to degrade, though some degrade slowly. They're not the same thing, and lumping them together as toxins makes it harder to prioritize.
Hannah's instinct to do what she can is psychologically healthy. The risk of doing nothing is genuine anxiety. But the most impactful actions are actually a pretty short list. Prioritize Dirty Dozen organic. Wash all produce thoroughly, even organic, because it still has residues from approved pesticides. Diversify your diet so you're not overexposed to any single chemical. Use ventilation when cleaning, and don't panic.
That last one is not flippant. The stress of trying to control everything is itself a health cost. Perfectionism is the enemy of progress here. You don't need to go 100% organic to meaningfully reduce exposure. A 20% reduction in the highest risk items gives you most of the benefit. If you're standing in the produce aisle tomorrow, the practical framework is actually pretty simple. Print out the Dirty Dozen and Clean 15, or just memorize the top few. Strawberries, spinach, kale, apples. Those are your organic priorities. Avocados, onions, pineapples. Don't bother.
For Hannah specifically, in Israel, strawberries, spinach, and apples are the ones to watch. Those consistently show the highest residue loads in local testing that aligns with the EWG data. If her CSA is delivering those organic, She's getting real value.
On the cleaning side, the highest leverage move isn't replacing everything with green products. It's getting the dangerous stuff out of the house. Drain cleaner, oven cleaner, bleach, and swapping in vinegar and baking soda for routine cleaning. Hot water and Castile soap for the floors. That handles 90% of what you need, and it costs basically nothing.
Castile soap is the unsung hero of parenting. It's just saponified vegetable oils. It cleans, it's safe if some gets in a mouth, and it doesn't leave a residue that a crawling toddler is going to pick up and ingest.
On the floor, licking specifically, I say this as a retired pediatrician. The floor is not the biggest risk in the room. Small objects, choking hazards, unsecured furniture, stairs. Those are the things that send one-year-olds to the emergency department. A clean floor matters, but perspective matters more.
The point here is that you don't need to be perfect. A 20% reduction in the highest risk pesticide exposures gives you most of the benefit. Anna's already doing the right things. CSA box, paying attention, asking questions. The goal isn't zero exposure. It's informed reduction without driving yourself crazy. One last thing, because this topic is moving fast and the answers might look different in 5 years. The EU has its farm-to-fork strategy, aiming to cut pesticide use 50% by 2030. If that actually happens, it reshapes the whole organic versus conventional equation.
Because if conventional farming gets cleaner, through precision agriculture, biopesticides, better regulation, then the premium you pay for organic stops being about safety and becomes purely about farming philosophy. And that's a different conversation.
The open question is whether organic becomes the default rather than the premium. If conventional pesticide loads drop far enough, the residue gap between organic and conventional shrinks to the point where the dirty dozen list stops mattering. Or the opposite happens. Organic certification becomes the only way to guarantee low residues, and the two-tier system gets more entrenched.
I think the more likely path is that precision agriculture and biopesticides make conventional farming cleaner without the organic label. Things like targeted spraying using drones, or biopesticides that target specific pests and degrade in hours rather than weeks. That's already happening. The question is whether it scales.
Which means the framework we've laid out today has a shelf life. It's right for now. In 5 years, the specific crops on the dirty dozen might shift, or the whole list might matter less. But the underlying principle, know which exposures matter, prioritize the highest leverage changes, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. That part ages fine.
For Hannah, the final thought is this. Your instinct to protect your family is not overkill. It's rational. The world is full of real chemical exposures, and a one-year-old is uniquely vulnerable. The key is to channel that instinct into actions that actually move the needle. The Dirty Dozen, the CSA, the Castile soap on the floor, rather than the ones that just feel good.
If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. It helps other curious listeners find us. And if you have a weird prompt you want us to tackle, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Thanks for listening.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.